The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir.
It is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly.
Yeah! David Cameron says he gets it. But how did he get the parliamentary maths so wrong over Syria? With the big vote lost and military action off the table, what will it mean for British foreign policy? And as the world's leaders bump shoulders at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, can they convince Vladimir Putin to toe the line? Stranger things have happened. Also this week, it's war. The GMB slashes £1 million from its funding of the Labour Party. Is this the end of the century-old marriage of Labour and the trades unions? Or just the beginning of the end? Or the end of the beginning? And talking money, universal credit or universal botched job? What will become of Ian Duncan Smith's master plan? What will become of Ian Duncan Smith? Join me for all of this, Guardian columnists Anne Perkins, Holly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. Welcome to all of you. As the atrocities mount in Syria, 4 million people have been displaced from their homes. 2 million have now fled the country. And civil war threatens to further destabilise the region. Whatever Britain can do to help, that help will not include military action. David Cameron was defeated, humiliatingly so, many say, on an already watered-down Commons motion that would have led to the deployment of British forces. Another fine mess, perhaps. Martin, if we recall that MPs were actually brought back from their summer holidays for this, there was a lot of planning went into it. How did this go wrong?
Well, I think partly because the MPs were away from Westminster, and so, you know, the heavying process to discipline them into line really only got underway at a late stage. But more fundamentally than that, I think it's because the policy doesn't command the support of enough Tories, and in a hung parliament, in a coalition, it was always going to be difficult. They either had to get the recalcitrant Tories on board, or they had to get Labour on board, or both. But in fact, they did neither, with the result that we see.
So is that a whipping failure? Does that mean that the Tory hierarchy just didn't know what its MPs were likely to do?
I think it's partly a whipping failure. It certainly is a whipping failure. But it's more than that. I mean, it's about Cameron's approach, his miscalculation, which is in some respects an echo of some of the problems that Blair had with Iraq, and the fact that the Tory party now contains a very significant minority, I think still a minority, you know, that basically is a pull up the drawbridge, Little England party, whether it's over Europe or whether it's over America or whether it's over intervention. They want to stop the world and remain on this island with white people in the majority.
Anne Perkins, pretty angry stuff at question time yesterday with the Prime Minister, clearly infuriated with the way that Ed Miliband has dealt with this.
Well, I mean, the Tory case is that there was really, you know, not a cigarette paper between the two motions, and it was Miliband playing politics that led him to whip his party behind the Labour amendment. And if they hadn't done that, then the Tories would have been all right at the end of the day. And I think, as Martin wrote in his column this morning, it is very peculiar that the House actually is fundamentally in favour of some kind of military action, but the impression left is that it's against. On the other hand, it's probably very good for the feeling of the public standing of Parliament, which is notably stronger off the back of this, because, you know, there's no doubt deep popular antipathy to the idea of any military adventure anywhere.
Surely the answer to that then is that just that the government just didn't make its case, that you have people who would have been broadly sympathetic to some kind of action, but just on the facts before them, they just didn't feel they could vote for it.
Well, I think this was an immensely political day, actually, because part of the Tory vote was about people who just wanted to, Tories who wanted to give Cameron a good kicking. And I think there was an element in the Labour Party who, you know, is always kind of quite tribal about this. And I think there's no doubt that Miliband himself shifted his position in the course of those few days before the vote. And he did back off support for intervention.
Doesn't this just mean that the government didn't make its case? Because clearly there were people there who were ready to listen to a well-made case.
Well actually, I think the problem was that people had come with positions, and therefore they weren't going to be open to any argument, and that's why the politics of it became the decisive influence.
So a lot going on behind the scenes. Polly, talk about Parliament, because the reaction of many people after this vote was,
hooray, we've got Parliament back, or Parliament has got its mojo back almost. Where do you think Parliament is now in terms of reflecting perhaps the will of the people?
I think it would have been very difficult for Parliament to vote when the people were at that point so strongly in favour of not intervening, not, or at least not at that speed, and not then, not that day, not to a very tight American timetable. I think it would have been very difficult to do it against public opinion. I mean, people forget, despite that huge demonstration at the time, Tony Blair did just manage to get public opinion on his side on the eve of the Iraq war, and I don't think he could have gone to war if he hadn't. Public opinion does matter to the Commons, and never more than on matters of war and peace.
So was it about the speed, because Tony Blair took more time shaping that opinion, and actually Cameron tried to get a decision very quickly?
I think that's right. I think, you know, people would have been much more suspicious this time. They no longer believe a couple of sides of A4 from security people with a very general and really very inadequate case. And I think that people do need to be persuaded. I think the words of John Kerry are busy persuading the American people. I think it's not that persuasion doesn't work, but there had been no time, nobody was prepared. It seemed to come out of nowhere. Suddenly, we're off to war in a couple of days, and nobody knew why. And after Iraq and Afghanistan have been such, well, to put it mildly, unsatisfactory conflicts, so much blood, so much money wasted, I don't think there's much appetite for it. But it doesn't mean never, as Martin says, it doesn't mean never. People may be persuaded if there were to be another gas attack or more atrocities, or if they were to see some way in which, be persuaded there was some way in which intervention would do good, because there was no evidence as to what the strategy was. There was no strategy. Let's drop some bombs as a punishment, because it mustn't go unpunished, but nothing beyond that.
So does that mean, Martin, that Labour should remain flexible because there are circumstances, maybe to use that Heseltonian construction, we cannot foresee them now, but there are circumstances in which there may have to be another vote and Labour may have to vote another way?
I think Labour should stay flexible because I think, you know, in general, that you can't generalise about these international crises. Each one of them has to be dealt with on its merits at the time in particular circumstances, and that's very much what happened here. But, you know, the reality of the politics, I think, is that, you know, Labour has no particular incentive at the moment to shift. And if it did shift, of course, then it would be accused immediately of being flip-flopping about the issue. So I think at the moment, what you're going to see is what you saw yesterday in the Commons. In other words, you know, two sides which actually agree about quite a lot, but absolutely not getting close to each other on this issue. It may be that at some stage down the road in Syria, in some months' time, not in days' time, that, you know, Britain might well get involved, but the situation would have to change very rapidly, in a very major way for that to happen.
And of course, if that happened, then people would then look at David Cameron's decision so quickly to rule out a second vote. Anne, was that smart?
That was just really odd. And right from the start, it sounded odd. It sounded just downright petulant. And I think it was a really serious misjudgment. I'm quite sure he must be regretting it. I thought that his tone in the Commons yesterday was very interesting. I thought the direct exchanges between Cameron and Miliband were conducted in quite a restrained and maybe even a slightly tentative way, and Cameron only really kind of let rip later on it's much easier to make fun of Miliband when he can't get up and answer back, and that's kind of how he decided to play it. But I would guess that, you know, he must be regretting that he made such a complete commitment.
This is the classic and most damaging example of David Cameron's utterly slapdash attitude towards almost all policy making. I mean, week after week, policies emerge that have been half thought through. They passed a catastrophic bill on lobbying this week, which will come back and bite them because it'll be unenforceable. And if it is enforced, there will be rebellion stopping people campaigning. You know, we've got the universal credit disaster, which we're about to talk about, one thing after another. They ignore the practicalities of things. And Cameron's, you know, at the head of that attitude.
Is there no value for him saying, I have listened? People say we never listen. Parliament expressed its view and I've listened.
He's got no choice, has he? He's forced to listen.
But he could have said, I've listened. He could have said, I've listened. And I'm quoting Martin again this morning. He does, you know, he could have said, you know, and I will reflect on what Parliament said. Yeah, he didn't have to rule it out. And the way he said it, he spat it out. He was furious.
He was petulant.
Yes.
I'm sure from the number of conversations I've had on this fascinating sort of 10-second moment in British politics a week ago, that it was basically done because Cameron had really had it up to here with Miliband over the previous 24 hours. They'd been very antagonistic to each other, been very rude to each other. Miliband had accused Cameron of being very slapdash on things. And they'd basically put themselves in the position where they weren't cooperating. And, you know, this was in a way the last straw for Cameron, because it's hugely humiliating. I mean, we forget just how humiliating it is. I mean, they try to the government's very good at trying to pour all the place all the blame on Ed Miliband's desk, and you know, some blame attaches to Miliband for this. I don't dispute that, but you know, prime ministers losing a grip of foreign and defence policy happens very, very rarely indeed. And, you know, you have to go back to something like Suez or, you know, Chamberlain in 1940. And these are great moments in British history. Or maybe Britain is now no longer a great power. And so, you know, a banal country has banal moments rather than great moments. But, you know, for a prime minister, it's a really humiliating thing. And he will be looked at by the establishment, the security services, the diplomatic service, the military, and their counterparts overseas as a weak figure from now on. And that is really humiliating.
Let's just very quickly delve into that, because, Polly, what about the special relationship now? There's a report this morning that at the G20, Obama will meet Hollande, France, but he won't meet Putin or Cameron. That's not good company to be in, is it really?
I think it's a bucket of cold water suddenly, where all kinds of people, perhaps the people Martin was talking about, the right-wingers who want to pull up the drawbridge, suddenly think, does little England really suit us? Does that feel all right to be ignored, to be an irrelevant small country stuck in the North Sea? Is that really who we are? I think we've got a lot of twists and turns to go yet before we find a comfortable role for ourselves. There are a lot of big questions. You know, Trident comes into this. Trident is entirely dependent on the Americans. It can't be used without the Americans say so. It's not independent in any sense. Our relationship with the Americans is crucial, and we're about to invest an enormous amount of money in that most umbilical of relationships. A lot of thinking needs to go on still before we decide who we are.
Just quickly, Anne, if this comes down to a statement as to where we really are as a country and what kind of weight we should try to punch in the world, is that a lot clearer now?
No, I don't think it is. And actually, I think this is kind of one of those odd moments that maybe, you know, in the history books will be taken seriously. But there are so many different factors playing in right now that to make great extrapolations from it, I think, would be a misjudgment. But I mean, I entirely agree with Polly. You know, this has been happening since Suez. It's been happening since, you know, 1948. You know, we are continually kind of trying to work out where we are in the world. But you can't overlook the fact that we do have it's not just Trident that ties us in to the Atlantic Alliance. It's all our, as we've been talking about a lot this summer, all our intelligence cooperation. It's our common cultural language. It's, you know, it's not something that's going to be shared easily any more than our soft power, our legacy of empire, is something that can be entirely shucked off. You know, we're never going to be, you know, a Nordic power because we don't have that kind of history.
Yeah. Well, if you have any idea where our place in the world really should be, you can add a comment below the line after listening to this podcast. And if you want to follow the latest diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing at the G20, you can do that on our website at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, moving on, there's been bad blood between Labour and the unions for some time. It's been simmering for a while. This week, with the statement from the GMB union, it boiled over ahead of next week's TUC conference. It could hardly have been a more incendiary statement of intent. This from the GMB union. The Central Executive Council has voted to reduce its current levels of affiliation to the Labour Party from 420,000 to 50,000 from 2014. Now, of course, that was a stunning development. And as I say, just before the TUC conference, it will cost Labour more than £1 million and could be just the beginning of a bitter divorce. There are some MPs who think lack of cash could actually cost Labour the next election. Polly, has Ed Miliband been smart on this one?
I think it's become increasingly inevitable, but once you lift the stone on this, you're going to find a lot of very unpleasant things underneath.
Should he have lifted it?
Well, I think it was inevitable. I mean, Falkirk was just a one straw in a lot of things that have been building up. You have to remember the extent to which the GMB throws its weight around in a lot of constituencies where quite a lot of quite unpleasant things go on in terms of the power they wield in terms of selections for local authorities, for council seats, as well as selections for MPs. And also that they've tried to influence Labour by saying Labour should purge anybody from the progress wing of the party, which is a kind of insanity. They themselves have taken a very sectarian attitude towards Labour Party policy. Who knows where this will end? It'll certainly end up with Labour very, very much poorer. But it is a good idea that people who are members of parties should know that they're members of parties, should sign up and agree that that's what they are. There will be many fewer of them than have been signed up without their knowledge by these trade unions. It doesn't stop the trade unions making very large donations if they wish to before the next election without pretending that they're attached to individual members. Paul Kenny of GMB can still give millions if he wants, and maybe he will, because in the end they know perfectly well that they don't want another Conservative victory.
And here's a hot ticket. Ed Miliband's actually at the TUC on Tuesday. That promises to be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, now this is it's a row that's been waiting to happen for a long time. It seems to me that the trade unions have been increasingly and understandably resentful that their bucks seemed to buy very, very little bang. And we've had a succession of agreements, but going back to 2005 and the Warwick Agreement, successive attempts to say to Labour, in power and out of power, you know, please listen to us, please adopt more of our programme, and they feel they've got nothing for it. No kind of substantive repeal of Tory legislation, which has made operating as a trade union extremely difficult. Really, you know, they've got almost crippling erosion of their membership, and they've got nothing to say to members to explain, they would argue, their commitment to Labour. So you kind of understand where they're coming from, but I just don't think this is a very constructive way of trying to find a better relationship. I think this is just a piece of kind of showmanship, but it could be where it's going to end up.
Should we actually take it at face value, Martin? Because there was one report this morning saying, keep a close eye on Paul Kenny. He's given himself plenty of time to reverse this. It doesn't actually kick in for a good while now. And maybe he's just playing hardball, trying to reconstruct the relationship with the party on terms that are more favourable to him.
Well, that may well be true. I mean, there is certainly that view that this is a kind of negotiating ploy.
And that he's a master of it.
And that, you know, that's what he does. I think the real problem with the trade unions in Britain today is rather like what I said in a piece this morning about Russia. They're both too strong and too weak at the same time. And that's the problem. I mean, there are no other organisations of significance in British life which represent working people effectively. You know, so trade unions matter, and they really do. But the problem with the trade unions is that they act as though they have only very traditional ways of operating, that, you know, that the past has somehow, they've got to kind of get back to the past and everything will be all right. Then the direction of travel is completely wrong, in my view. I mean, they should be modernizing and thinking about how they can be much more effective in the three quarters of the workforce which they don't represent, and they should be much less committed to the Labour Party than they are. They should be much more pragmatic, in my view. You know, if they want to give, I don't see why they don't give money to the Liberal Democrats, the Tories, and the Scottish Nationalists, and UKIP. You know, they should be representing members. They should be representing people at work, and it's the old 19th and early 20th century notion that, you know, by binding together in a party of Labour, the unions will win the world. is wrong. It's not going to ever happen again. I just think, you know, they should be much more fly and much more generally promiscuous. And they'd be much more successful if they were.
Well, I do think, actually, the trade unions have worked very hard at modernising, and they work very hard at recruiting, and they struggle against, you know, the atomisation of the workforce.
That's true.
And, you know, the GMB would say, well, you know, we are actually a growing union. And they really do, and they've, you know, they've really reformed themselves about how they represent women. Maybe not as fast and as effectively as they should, but they have tried, and I think they are trying, and they do really good work in a lot of difficult workplaces as
totally
well.
Agree.
One thing that Labour should offer them, which they don't seem to be asking for but would make a lot of difference, is that every single workplace should have an obligation at least once a year to let in a trade union representative to talk to the workforce about what trade unions are and to offer them the chance to join. They would be hugely resisted by employers, but most people under the age of about 45 have never come across a trade union, barely know what it is. They know Bob Crowe's face on the telly, and that's about it. And we really need to get unions back as a part of the normal part of life. And it's very good that Labour wants to have them at least on remuneration committees. I think we should have, in German style, you know, worker representatives on boards and reintegrate the idea of trade unions as a normal part of everybody's lives.
I agree with that, but that has to be, that's a completely different model of trade unionism to what the great majority of the major British trade unions are in any way used to or comfortable with.
Well, we'll see on Tuesday whether or not they can get a bit closer to a model that works for all of them. One rather doubts it, but one can hope. Everywhere, prominent people feeling the pressure, and someone else feeling the heat this morning in Westminster is the Welfare Secretary Ian Duncan-Smith. His flagship Universal Credit Programme, which was designed to bring efficiency and banish waste, has been slammed by the National Audit Office as wasteful and badly managed. IDS, who assured the Commons that everything was tickety-boo, came out fighting today. His line seemed to be, it all went wrong and now it's all gone right again. Polly, I'll ask you this, but I suspect I know the answer. Are we surprised?
We're not at all surprised. It was always a disaster waiting to happen. It's a very good idea that successive governments since the early 80s have looked at. It makes sense to bring together the tax records and the benefit records and put them together and into one system. But it is fiendishly complicated to do. We already know what happens to vastly overambitious IT programmes. And so it was a disaster. What's more, he has gone on and on denying it. He has appeared in the Commons until very recently, swearing blind that everything was on course, on budget, on time, when it plainly wasn't. The timetable has already slipped many times. I've been to lots of meetings with Lord Freud, who's in charge of it, swearing that everything was right, when we have all heard so many whistleblowers from right inside the system cataloguing how catastrophic it's been for a very long time. I don't understand why Ian Duncan-Smith wasn't moved in the way that Lansley was when it was plain that it was all going belly up.
Martin, shouldn't there be repercussions from that if the Secretary of State comes before the House and says, this plan you want to talk about is all going absolutely fab, and then we find out that actually in that same time period everyone knew it wasn't, don't they need to call him back and say, you seem to have misled us?
Well, that may well happen. And, I mean, there is a reshuffle likely to take place at some level in the government in the next few days or weeks. And maybe that will happen. Of course, IDS is in a particularly strong position personally because he is a former leader of the party and he is regarded with affection by the party. They feel they did him... They have the guilt of a party that knifed him as leader, and therefore they are... You know, he's not necessarily... Going to be the first name on the list for the chop. I've just been reading a book called Blunders of British Governments by Anthony King and Ivor Crewe, which actually stopped short of the 2010 coalition in terms of the cataloguing of the institutional failures.
That's the next whole
project failures, but there'll be a volume two is clearly going to be written. But I mean, it is striking how this does fit with that history. And I think you just have to... I would just say one word of caution, however, which is the private sector gets things massively wrong too. We mustn't get into the habit of mind which says, you know, government can't do things. Big organisations find things, you know, get things wrong, and the private sector and public sector. The problem with public sector ones is which are often much more transparent than private sector ones, is that politicians operate on a much shorter timescale and are pressing for solutions and actions and achievements before they can reasonably expect
to happen. One reason why the public sector finds it more difficult is that they're always trying to do very much more difficult things. I mean, Sainsbury's entire new IT system fell over when really all it was trying to do was get stuff into shops and sell it. If you think what the NHS tries to do, the complexity of people's records and getting them to every possible doctor or hospital that might ever need to access them, or you look at the complexity of everybody's tax and everybody's benefit and pension affairs, these are far more difficult projects than a private sector ever has to face.
It's also the case that actually that most of the work is actually done in the private sector for these huge IT contracts anyway, and there's some interesting argument about how good Whitehall is at managing them. But I think on the layer you have to add on top are all the different political and transparency constraints of doing things in the public. And I think it's very interesting the way Frances Maud actually tried to introduce a kind of more rigorous process for assessing and monitoring these kind of big adventures in technology. And I think, you know, in lots of ways, they've probably been quite good. I mean, they did scale this back before it kind of completely blew up, and they are going more slowly. And I feel quite strongly, one, that this is fundamentally, if it could be made to work, it should be made to work, universal credit. You know, it's actually, I think, you know, negative income tax was first proposed, you know, in the 1960s. And secondly, I think that government's got to learn how to do these things, because this is the way government is going to be done. And we need to find how to manage, how to develop, how to manage, how to design these projects if we're going to have effective government in the future.
Yes, people should understand, because universal credit sends shudders through anybody on any kind of benefit, because people forget that what we're talking about is the envelope, the system. You can be as generous or ungenerous with it according to what party's in power. So if Labour were to be handed a fully working universal credit system, it could be far more sensitive to whatever the government of the day wants to do. But it's been absolutely poisoned by the fact that it's come in with very severe cuts at the same time. And of course, when it does go wrong, somebody missing even 1 week's benefit projects them into borrowing from Wonga from when onwards, a downward spiral. It really matters.
Okay, well, we will try and monitor the progress of that, but of course we'll try and use a better IT system than the one they were using on Universal Credit. But that's all we have time for this week. We're back next Thursday, but in the meantime, tune into our Australian Politics Weekly special that has full analysis of this weekend's general election down under. Until then, thanks to all of our guests, Polly Toynbee, Martin Kettle and Anne Perkins. The producer of this podcast was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thank you for listening.